Once again, welcome to Rover Talk. This is our third episode in this series, and as usual, right next to me is our beloved Dan, Wagon Boy TD is his Instagram handle, and also his handle from Bring a Trailer. Dan, today someone called you a walking Land Rover manual.
I don't know if that's a good thing or
I don't know, but that's
nice though.
It's definitely a walking Land Rover manual was the description that I had from Dan today. Anyway, today we're going to cover a lot of ground, and our episode is called The Best Bang for Your Buck and How the Market is Responding. Now, we're going to cover a lot of different marks, a lot of different models within Land Rover, some classic, some a little bit more modern. We're just here to tell you a little bit what's going on in the market, what is up in price, what's down in price, what is there to buy, is there anything to avoid? And I don't think there is, but I'm sure we're going to have a lot of different opinions. Anyway, we want to make sure we cover everything. So, Dan, all you, Series Rovers.
So Series, of course, as we all know, have been around forever. They've been in the market for, you know, a very long time. So usually kind of how I recommend people to buy is, A, never buy sight unseen because the Series will more often than not rust, and that's where the bulk of your money is going to go into. So if possible, just always try and see one in person. Usually can pick them up anywhere from 8 to 20 grand. They're still a good value if all you need is, you know, an iconic farm truck.
And I agree. But here's the thing, too, to keep in mind. These are very easily modifiable. So it's probably on the harder side to find something that's original than it is to find something that's been gone through in a certain way. Right?
Yeah, because we've all touched our Series 1,000 times. And so finding one that's original, like a 1, even a 2, is pretty much next to impossible. So those will just never be a deal anymore.
Cool. But now, what's the difference in pricing Series 1, Series 2A, Series 3?
Well, 1, you'll often see them. I've seen a couple close to six figures. It just depends on how original they are. But just take 2As and 3s. You can get 3s in the 10 to 15K. 2As, I just sold one of mine not that long ago, and I got in the 20s. So it really just depends on the extent. I'm a true believer in patina in Series. Like, I absolutely do not like ones that have been overly restored. I think they actually hold more value than the ones that are restored.
I was offered, actually, I don't know if I told you this. I might have sent you a message about this, but I was offered a Series 1 56 gas engine, 80, it would be an 80-inch, I would guess.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. For 25. And that's Euros. This car is located in Spain. What do you think?
And it's...
It looks pretty well restored. Yeah. I mean, I'm still waiting to get some clarification on what's been done to it, because in Spain people tell you it's been restored, and then all of a sudden it's just that they repainted it.
Right. No, we've seen many cars that had just been, you know, painted, which, you know, the Galvi bits are always painted. But is it a true UK Series 1?
Yeah, it's a Series 1. It's a Series 1. It wasn't made in Spain because it's 56.
Right, that would have been later.
Yeah. So what do you think?
Again, I someone has to see it.
Yeah, I agree with you there. So out of all the Series Rovers, what would you buy right now?
Well, I mean, I could tell you right now that I would just continue to buy a 3, because I've had 2s, 2As. I've gotten rid of them. You know, it really just depends on what sort of collector you are. So if you're a first timer into the Series, then you're gonna want a 2A. Like, I mean, that's just plain and simple. You have the iconic dash. If you go later in the 2A, there's no double clutching. There's just so much about the 2A that's easy for a first timer, and you still can get them you know, well priced, especially if you're willing to drive a right hand drive, which to me is like, that's how I want my Series, because that's what I think of. You know?
Now, if you're thinking here right now that you don't want a Series 2A because you can't go through the drive-through window, turn off the podcast. This isn't for you. Anyway.
I mean, A, then you just, exactly.
Or that you can't get into a parking garage. Again, turn off the podcast. Not for you.
Yeah. So, you know, I had to narrow it down, so I chose what was best for me. And for me, if you've seen my Instagram, you know that I love my Series 3.
So I kind of differ with Dan here. I think that if you're a first-time collector, you should definitely go to a Series 3. I think there's going to be a little bit of a difference in price because Series 2A are slightly more collectible because of their look and the central dash.
But you have to remember, there's a lot of them. I mean, that's like the most produced one. So, you know, you can find them, you know, a lot easier.
And, well, yeah, you're right in that. And the other thing, too, is that you want to avoid anything that has a lot of rust underneath because you're going to be doing a lot of rust repair, which is obvious with any car. So it kind of depends on the condition and kind of what you're looking for. And, of course,
and if you're not a body guy, I mean, all your money's going out the window just on that type of restoration.
True. But you can also go and buy out a lot of new body panels, which are pretty cheap. It's just getting them put in. But I'd say Dan says 2A. I think a little bit of Series 3. I think all of these trucks are growing in value as of the last 3 to 4 years, and especially, you know, in the past, hence, you know, skip coronavirus into all this, but in the past year or so, I think they're just really cool, iconic shapes, and I've seen a really spike in value. I wanted to pick up a couple of Series 2As about 3 years ago, and I didn't pull the trigger on any because I didn't see the market pulling up. And I recently sold that 2A for $25,000 on Bring a Trailer, $24,000. And I think that's a low price for what the car was, but I think we're also at the end of September. You know, I'm not sure it's the best car buying time or at least car selling time, but I think right there is the sweet spot. And that car, for example, 3 years ago, I would not have bought because I didn't think it would make it past maybe 17, 18, 19.
Yeah.
Right? Cool. So remember, let's get back on track here. Our Series 2A, Series 3, remember your condition. Everything that Dan's telling you, right-hand drive is probably going to be a little bit cheaper, and there's probably going to be a little bit more. And it's definitely a rising market. Has it peaked? I think probably. So we're probably going to stick at those values, but we'll have to see what next spring brings to us.
You have to keep in mind, too, that all the boomers that were huge into the series in the 70s, 80s, you know, we're seeing a lot of those come to market as they kind of age out, and all the Gen Xers are like picking them up now. So
yeah, very cool. So the other real quickly before we go on to talk a little bit about Defenders, I wanted to make a little point here for Santanas. So in case we're gonna do a dedicated episode on Santana Land Rovers, but I wanted to say that basically, a Santana Land Rover up to about 1983 is the exact same as a British-made solo hole 1983 up to 1983 Land Rover. So the Series 2A, Series 2, if there's a Series 1 Santana, which I think there isn't, so Series 2 would be the first, even Series 3, they're all basically going to be the same. They're going to have different names on the gauges and stuff like that and different badging. But basically every single part that you can find for normal Land Rover Series 3 is going to be available for Santana. So they're basically the same thing, and they're probably going to have a diesel engine if that's your cup of tea. Not much difference between 2.25 diesel and 2.25 gas. But anyway, so let's get back on track. Defenders.
So
this is the big one.
Well, I mean, it is in a sense that because it's probably, as we all know, the most volatile market.
Hold on. Let me interrupt you real quick. We have to remember that the Defender name and brand and the car that is a official Defender is from 1990 going forward. So anything that you see between the last of the Series 2A or the last of the Series 3 Land Rovers and 1990 is going to be a Defender 90, a Defender 110, or it's going to be a Land Rover 90, Land Rover 110, or Land Rover 130. It's not a Defender. Defender's 90.
Which
90
is
forward, right?
Yep. Which has been like the biggest problem over the last at least 10, 15 years. Ever since we were able to start legally importing actual Defenders and whatnot into the States from, you know, the European and the UK market. So one of the big issues that we always see with this market is that it is extremely volatile. You'll see something at Barrett Jackson that's, you know, a 92 UK Defender that, like, some drunk guy buys for 120K, and then it messes up the market because then everybody and their brother thinks every Defender is now worth 120K, but that's what liquor does to some people at an auction. But what I wanted to kind of hone in is a lot of people know that I kind of go after the NOS and its value and how I think that it's kind of...
NOS being North American specification or North American...
Yes. Okay. So it was made for the American market. Very, very limited. Everybody knows that they're extremely limited quantity, and also knows that the value, to me, in my opinion, is mostly because of the fact that the uber extreme environmental nation of California is basically this is the only Defender.
So basically the value is that it can be registered in California with no issues.
Yes, and the limitation of production and the fact that, like, everybody in California wants these. So the market has dictated that they can command, on average, I'm going to say 75 to 80K, which is more than double the original MSRP. You have to remember, they originally came out around 28K to 30K, depending on if you added in the air conditioning into the 97.
What do you think is a good price to pay for a Defender?
A NOS?
Any Defender. I mean, because if you're looking for a Defender and you're not a resident or you don't want to register it in California, then basically you have an open market for the most part in any state.
Right. So if you take NOS out of the picture. So to me, a good example of a NOS, meaning if it's a Southern NOS, a West Coast NOS, it actually shows the fact that the frame is intact and it isn't super modified, a good realistic price, and you see this average price paid is about 80 to 85. So, you know, you'll have people that will constantly list them at like 119, 120, 115, depending on like mileage is under, you know, 20,000. But to me, the fair value, I think, is in that 80 range. You know, I've had a 94, a 95.
What do you think? Okay, so with that value in mind, is it affected by being a 90 versus a 110, and then the special breed of 130?
The thing is you'll never see actual 110 NOSes. Like those are worth six figures, just because of the fact that they're so incredibly rare. Like, they really brought none of them into the States. So when you do see a 93 pop up, people usually go pretty crazy because, A, they never come to market, and the fact that it's a 110 NOS. Like, that's the only thing. That's the only one that I think is worth six figures.
Okay. So if you're buying a Defender, like, what is it? What are your key spots, or what do you want to look for, aside from the condition stuff?
So, as we mentioned before, a true Defender is going to be, you know, post 1990. Your best return of investment is if you just start off right away with a left-hand drive, because obviously it's more easy, you know, it's a lot easier to resell. You know, the thing that we're seeing is most of these 90s that have been coming over for like the last 5 years are all pretty much going to be diesel. So, you know, you kind of have to look at it. Do I want a diesel 90? Do I want to have like that? And then you can think about putting in like a 4.0 gems and then kind of have that similar experience that you would with a NOS without having to pay that sort of NOS value. So you can easily get defenders, let's say from 90 to 95, you can easily get them in the 20K range. And if you wanted to pop in a gems, you know.
What about auto versus manual?
Well, I mean, we both know where we stand on the experience. You know, I'm a manual guy, you know, through and through ever since I've been driving. You know, that's just how I am. You know, the rarity is most of those imports are all going to be manual. So, you know, you kind of have to go in thinking, you know, if I want to pay a lot less, I better be willing to drive a manual most of the time, you know.
So, for example, I know of a collector here in Chicago that has a 90... God, I can't remember the year. It's either 94, 95, 96, or 97. 90 soft top, red, beautiful condition, 17,000 miles. He wants $125 for it.
Of course he does. So
NOS, obviously.
So it has to be a 97.
Well, it's a 97 then. I can't
remember. Yeah, if it's an automatic, then it's a 97. And if it has AC, like, I mean, that's nice to want. 125, but you know, we don't see them trading that often for that. You know, I'll give you an example. So there was a 97 Arliss that had like 3,000 miles that sold at this estate sale. It was like 200K, insane. And within like a year later, I believe they could barely, it went unsold just because, you know.
Well, that was a poorly bought car, right?
Well, that was, I mean, that was, I don't know if they were drunk, but like,
somebody,
I mean, that's just insane. Like,
yeah, I think those prices are out of whack. So,
I mean, really, like I said, it really comes down to the fact that like during the late, the second half of the 2000s, we were seeing obnoxious totals being realized at some of these big tent houses for defenders that actually really weren't like what I call, you know, true defenders.
Yeah. So overall, what would you buy or where's the sweet spot with a defender? I'm going to tell you where I think mine is, but.
So like I had mentioned, I've had them and I've dumped them, but that's for another episode as to why I don't drive defenders anymore. But you can get really good defenders in the
20s.
Yeah.
So here's my cup of tea on this one's a little bit different. I've actually never owned a defender, believe it or not. And I've been close to buying a few, but I love this series so much that it seems to me like an over-evolved series, but that's my impression only. And I think the money is in if you can find a 130. Now, for those of you that don't know what the 130 is, the 130's got four doors and a pickup bed. And those are actually pretty rare. They're not super easy to find. And now that the new Jeep Gladiator came out, it kind of looks like a Gladiator, yeah. Or the Gladiator looks like this.
And it depends on who built it too.
Yeah, I think that if you can find an original 130, you know, in decent state that you can put some money into to make it better. And by making it better, I don't mean modifying it. I just mean getting up to spec, making sure the engine is right, making sure it doesn't
just
have any
getting
rust.
It safe.
Just getting it, yeah, getting it safe. Or maybe, you know, swapping out the suspension brakes, stuff like that. I think that is where you're going to get a lot of the defender enjoyment out of it because it's a really cool truck.
I mean, it really just depends on what you want.
And when you get tired of it, you're probably going to see a little bit of money on the back end, depending on what you put into it.
You'll definitely see money if you don't, like, spectre it out or, like, over-modify it.
Yeah,
for
that's,
sure.
Well, that's, yeah, I agree. So That's our little take on defenders, and
again, we could probably go on for hours.
Well, we could. And another thing that I know Dan would probably say with me is that, you know, it's not worth it to buy a NOS. It just really isn't, unless you live in California and absolutely need to register it there.
Yep, that's 100%.
And if not, go to Montana and open up an LLC and register it there. Anyway, I didn't say that. So, Dan, I know we're coming to the part of the show of your least favorite.
Oh, what, the P38?
Oh, the least the least favorite of your. So Dan and I have gone back and forth with the P38 for oh, for years, I would say. I'm going to let you give your opinion on the P-38 before I get into it.
Well, it's easy. It's, and I mentioned this in the last episode, to me, it's just the design. Like, it's like a classic little brother with a rear that's on steroids. Like, there's just, the design to me just didn't, it just didn't cut it. And part of it, too, is like at that point in my life, when it came out, kind of has something to do with it, but it really just is the design aspect of it.
So the P-38 Range Rover came out in 1995 for the U.S. market.
Right at the crossover between the classic.
Yeah, 94 for the European market. And it was kind of, well, it was actually the first major redesign the Range Rover had had since new. Because everything from when it came out in 68 all the way up to 95 kind of looks the same. There's, you know, little bits and bobs here, the bumpers, the windows, little things that have been redesigned. But basically, it was the first general redesign. I honestly really, really like them. And I know that everybody...
But look at the age difference between us, though. I think that partially has a bit to do with it as well. Just like where we were at our life when that came out.
That could be the case. Anyway... I really like the P-38. I think it's a really cool shape. I think it maintains those little details like the hood when you drive it still has the little lumps on the front, kind of like the original, like the classic has the split.
Are you talking about the little castellations that are like right at the bonnet there?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It has the split tailgate, which I think is a cool little detail.
I will give you that. I've always loved a split. You know,
split rear door, split tailgate's always cool. And here's the thing about them. I think they are probably the best bang for your buck in all the Range Rover line right now. And I'm going to tell you a couple of things here. And I've been through, and everybody that knows them or has read about them is probably thinking, you're an idiot because the air suspension is going to go bad, which it is, and it's going to have electrical gremlins, which it will also have. Now, here's the thing, though.
So it's a Land Rover.
It's a Land Rover. Okay. It's a Land Rover, yeah. So here's the thing. I've had this discussion with a lot of people, and especially with somebody from a Spanish car club, where they fight me back on replacing the air suspension for coil and springs. The kit on British Atlantic, I think, is like $1,000. I mean, it's not an expensive thing to do, and I think it's much better than the air suspension. Now, of course, it doesn't duck down on the highway and go into low mode when you're going over 65 or 70. I think it goes over into that, but... I think it's a great improvement, and your suspension should be changed by the time it goes bad on any car. You should change it. So it's not like a big deal. The electrical gremlins usually have to do with the wiring, and if you have a good electric guy or somebody that knows these cars or you find somebody, you can usually figure it out pretty quickly. The fuse box is going to need to be replaced, and you know, likely that you're probably going to go through a flex plate on the clutch if you have the 4.6 and all that. But it's a really cool car. If you can find a low-ish mileage, under 100,000, that is in decent shape, doesn't have any rust underneath, and runs decently, and by runs I'm referring to the engine, not the suspension. It's going to wobble a little bit.
So what do you think you can find a P-38 for? Like if I were to like do a search.
I think you can find a good P-38. For less than $5,000.
Now, a good P-38, is that a northern car or a southern car?
It depends on how it's been taken care of.
Yeah.
I mean, it most likely it's going to be a southern car or western, west coast car. Yeah. Most likely.
Yeah.
Right?
I remember up until like maybe 2 years ago, I could go on like Craigslist Chicago and I could at least see like 8 to 10 of them. I'm lucky now if I see one. Or two, maybe.
I think it's a car that in 2 or 3 years is going to be commanding a lot higher prices than it is now. And especially if you pick up one of the special editions, if you pick up a Vitesse or a 50th or 40th anniversary, I think it is, or the Callaway edition,
right.
Or a few different ones that have special unique colors on the outside and a few little unique features on the inside. Look, these are really, they're really cool cars. And here's the thing, too. They are actually super comfortable cars for daily use.
They are.
They are. I mean, I would have kept mine, But then again, I didn't buy it to keep it.
No.
But I will have another P-38. And they have a cool line of colors. The Alpine White looks great. You know, if you can get like a yellow or red.
I think the draw obviously will be to find a red one. Because the older millennials, maybe the young Gen Xers,
yeah,
really loved the fact that Michael Jordan had one. And, of course, they showed it in The Last Dance. You know, so it kind of got like kind of a – and I actually just got goosebumps. That's really sad for a P-38. But
see, you're going to have one. I'm telling you. One of these days I'm going to show up at your house and I'm going to have one.
But
and it's going to be for you.
No. Having Michael Jordan, having driven one, definitely has that draw for the P-38.
Here's the thing about the P-38, and it kind of goes with the Range Rovers in general. The P-38 is absolutely a car that you can use on a daily basis. You can get it insured with classic car insurance and paid nothing for it.
Yeah.
And if you take care of the suspension when it goes bad, just when it goes bad, and the idea, and ideally you swap out either the whole system and get it back and into, you know, air suspension, or you override the system and do your coil and spring, which is the way to go in my eyes, and you deal with the electrical gremlins that you're going to have. I just think it's a really cool car.
And we've seen them jump up into the mid-20s lately on, like, Bring a Trailer. Just had a couple of green ones pop off at like 24 grand. So
my advice is, if you find a sub 50,000 mile car for less than 10 grand, buy it, hold it in your garage, and use it every once in a while. Make sure it's started in a couple of years. Put it on the market, and you're going to make your money back probably twofold.
Yep, that's a good one.
Dan, L322.
So that is currently probably one of my best bang for the bucks. Mainly, I say that because...
How many do you have?
Just two. Just two. I have an 06 and an 08. The L322, the 06 to 08 is the second series, and we know that it came off of the BMW engine of the first series and replaced it with the Jag and Ford components. I say it's the best bang for the buck because when they first came out, they were, for just the full-size HSE, was close to 80 grand. And then if you got the supercharged of the full, it was close to 100 grand. Now you can buy these 06s to 08s anywhere from, I'd say, for like, maybe in the fives to...
But just, in the five, you're getting a basket case.
You are getting a basket
or
case.
Or 200 miles, 200,000 miles, right?
Or over 150,000 miles.
Okay.
Which isn't, you know, I wouldn't always shy away from something that's over 150,000 miles, providing it's had all the majors done up until then, and it's, you know, in decent shape. But the buys are pretty good right now. You can get any of these up to like, you know, 12 grand for in the 50K mile range.
So, but let's make a clear distinction here. I know the model comes out in 2002. So there's a first run 2002 to 2005, which is
the BMW. And then it switches over to the Jag in 06 to 09.
Now,
which is like the preferable. I mean, for me, I just prefer.
When did you think you would be saying that you preferred something with a Jag engine?
Well, versus a BMW engine.
I have a Jag problem, so we know that too.
Yeah.
But yes, believe it or not, the 2006 to 2009 is the Jag engine. It's the sweet spot of the car.
Yes.
And probably the best bang for your buck.
It is. For right now, it really is. If you compare the Lux details to what you would have gotten at for 80K, I can't believe it's already been almost 15 years now since that second series came out.
And look at it versus the 2020 model. There's not all that much of a difference.
No, except for the fact that I think that this series holds truest to the classic form, which is kind of why I was drawn to it. To begin with, just the size and how closely it looks to the original classic.
Now, Dan, I'll let you know that Dan is guiding me through my first L322 purchase, which is probably going to happen
and
shortly.
You're not the first person that I've gotten on.
We know that.
Onto these, and everybody that has just absolutely fallen in love with them.
But you always didn't recommend it against the supercharged version.
No, so, you know, it really just depends on what you want. I always preferred, like, simple, because I like to be able to do as much as I can on my cars. So if something is, like, supercharged, that just means something else that I have to then either pay someone else to work with any issues, or I have to try and figure it out. You know, the difference between that I don't like in the series is that there's the less expensive package, which I think you mentioned that you actually like the sports, the design of the sport. But I think that they missed the mark on the sport styling versus the full size.
Good that you bring that up. This is the first time that there's actually a secondary model of Range Rover within the Range Rover line.
Because it was a cheaper version. It was $25,000 less, the starting base. So, you know, it was more available to, I guess, more people. The reason, again, and it comes back to like the P38, I just do not like the rear end styling on the sport.
We've gone back and forth on this, and honestly, after seeing Dan's L322 in the original Range Rover body, I'm not considering a sport. I only want an original one.
And I've done a lot of side by side comparison shots on my Instagram, and it's crazy how really close the DNA is.
Hopefully, by the time we do our next one, I'll have one of these and. And we can talk
but
about
I would
more
definitely
about it,
but. Recommend picking up an 06 to 08. We've already seen on Cars and Bids them outselling what you would find if you just did a little bit of homework. So, like, that's a sweet spot for me, is that 06 to 09 range, full-size HSC.
Do you think this is the next Range Rover that's going to grow in value, kind of like what we expect from a P38, or what we're already starting to see from a P38, and maybe, you know,
I think so, because if you do like a rudimentary search, like nationally, there's not that many available. So what's happening is that people are kind of realizing that it's a great vehicle, and the low mile ones are being snatched up. There's plenty out there that are 150,000, 140, but the ones that were barely driven in the last 15 years, we're finding that they're really hard to find right now.
The other cool thing about this car is that the vast majority, if you find them with low ownership, were usually purchased by people that had them sleep in the garage and never drove them off-road.
Yeah.
Which is always kind of...
I mean, just like any other car, I always recommend two or less owners.
Yeah.
Especially in these Land Rovers. It's just best to have, as always with any car you buy, as much service records that you can possibly have with it. And the fewer the owners, the better.
And there you go. So there's your L322. So now let's swap over to the Disco. So we've mentioned this, I think, in a previous episode, but the Land Rover Discovery was started in Europe in 89-90. Two-door versions and four-door versions were available at the same time. TDI engines, 200 TDI, then 300 TDI, plus the V8. And I believe there was not a gas six-cylinder engine added to these?
There was.
Yeah. That was also very rare to find these even in Europe. But anyway, 94 is when we got them in the U.S. U.S. had only the four-door model. V8 engine... I mean, there were some TDIs in the U.S. or no? No, I don't think we got those in the U.S. So only, and every once in a while you could find with a manual transmission. But I'd say 99.5% of those are going to be automatic. Dan, you have a.
I have a what I call it a like a pre-A, which is it's the very first European series. So I have a 93 Discovery. TDI with a 200 in it.
And
two doors.
Two doors. There you go.
Yep. Had to have two doors.
Wasn't that a cool find?
Oh, yeah. And who found that for me?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was me.
And, I continue to thank you.
And
for
then
that.
I basically gave it away. But that's okay. You're a friend. Yeah, that's okay.
Friend.
That's what it is.
Friends and family discount.
Plus, whenever I want, I can drive it around.
Yep.
Anyway, so Dan, what do you think about discos in general?
So we were talking about this earlier about the first gen being increasingly very difficult to find in good condition. So that market has kind of almost cycled back around again. So there was a couple of peaks where these early disco ones were, you know, selling close to like $20,000. Now they've kind of like settled down a little bit into the mid-teens for, you know, fairly decent examples. But again, you maybe 10 years ago, 8 years ago, you could go on Craigslist and there'd be dozens of them. Yeah. You know, just like everything else, they kind of disappear.
No, I agree with you there. The other thing, I'm going to add a quick tidbit here. I went through Senegal and Mauritania in a disco and a Pegaso Spanish military truck, which, by the way, is the most outstanding 4x4 vehicle I've ever seen in my entire life, because it would not get stuck anywhere, even with, I would say, like, dug into 3 feet of sand. Anyway, the Disco is actually a very cool off-roader. It was very versatile. This was a TDI. It was manual. I remember the only problem we had is that the brake servo went out. So for a while, we didn't have really brakes, and we kind of had to crash it into the truck to get it to stop. But, I mean, that was, you know, these things happen to you in the middle of Africa. Best part was that I had dual sunroof, so we'd take out the sunroof and hang out the back, and, you know, had some stairs and a roof rack. Anyway, really cool car to off-road in. Super comfortable. We must have done at least, you know, a couple thousand miles, so it was really comfortable. So it's actually, when you see those images of these cars in their natural habitat or, you know, doing one of the camel trophies, they really are capable off-roaders.
Yeah.
But anyway, where's the sweet spot in the market? What do you think? What do you think is the value, or what should people expect to pay for a disco?
So if you're talking like the D1s.
And let's talk about what's available domestic market, because.
Right. Foreign. So if you're 96s, 97s seem to be where most of them are falling as far as what's available, and anywhere in that like 12 to 16 for like a really decent under 100,000 miles. You'll see them go trying being sold for like in the upper 20s, but usually they're like super, super modified.
Now, I know you know this, but let's address here the three amigos. I think I'll let you do that. Well, if you're going to buy a disco and there are three dash lights that are the ABS, I believe it's the traction control.
Yep.
And the third one is the, is it the check engine or is it the?
Check engine.
Check engine. So if you start up a disco and those three lights pop up on your dash.
Say thank you very much. You know, a lot of people, it's kind of, so if you're mechanically inclined, like obviously some of our listeners are gonna be, they're not gonna run from that. They're gonna use it as a bargaining tool. So it's kind of twofold. If you're just looking for a disco that because you love the iconic design of it, but you're not mechanically inclined, that's when you say, "I really love this truck, but thank you." You know. I would walk away because you just don't know really what you're getting into. Whereas if you talk to someone that's a mechanic, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, that's like no big deal.
By the way, you know, like with every Land Rover, get underneath the and I have to say this out of pure experience. I purchased the two-door in Spain. I brought it over here and the floor was rotting out. And I didn't see that when I bought it because it was hidden to me. The rocker panels on these, especially at the A-pillar, the drain gets clogged up, and they start to rot from the inside out.
Yep.
So be aware of this. Just check it. And if it has sideboards, you know, really get underneath the car. Look
That's
beyond
a
the sideboard.
Problem.
Yeah.
And then the rear seams, which is on the chassis of actually most of the you know, whether it's a classic, anything, there's these seams that are that you'll find on the rear chassis where they also water goes in from the top, sits in the channel in the frame, and then will like rust, as he mentioned, from the inside out.
Now, for everybody to know, these cars were had a design fault in their drainage system. So if it's a place where it rained a lot, it's going to have rust because the water didn't get out fast enough from all the different places. So you're going to want to check that, you know, just be aware of it. And here's the thing, though. You can actually buy the kit to repair the outer sills and the rocker panels. And there's a guy in the UK that sells them. I think the kit's only like $500 for all the parts, and they're ready to weld on. So if you can weld and you can cut metal, you can solve the problem for about $500-$600 plus a bit of spare, you know, a bit of scrap metal that you can find, or metal parts that you can get around there. So it's all about that. And if you're that handy, but they are really cool cars, and they're just a blast to drive.
Yeah. I mean, I daily drive mine literally from April 1st to October 31st here in Chicago.
So I don't want to run too long today, and I know we've gone through a vast majority of models, but there's...
So, go ahead.
No, go.
So I was just going to say, let's talk about Disco 2s and what we're seeing happening right now in the 03, 04 market. We've seen in the last 12 to 18 months, we've seen prices on the 03, 04 like skyrocket to record levels that we really didn't expect. So we're seeing examples sell close to $30,000 on auction sites where, you know, everybody at home on their keyboard is like, mother F, these are on Craigslist for like $5,000. Well, if you find a good $5,000 03-04 that's not toast underneath,
send us the link
because I'll keep buying them even though I'm not like a Series 2 fanatic. That's a hell of a deal. So if you're seeing really good examples like out southwest or in the south and you're seeing them, you know, under 10K in really decent shape, those are the years that you want.
That's a great buy. And it's totally a usable daily driver car for absolutely everything.
Yes.
So the less talked about or known cars, I guess, of the more modern Land Rover series are LR2, 3, and 4.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of these in Europe I think it was the 3. The 3 or the 4, and I can't remember if 3 ended
Hondas,
the 4.
Like labeled under something else?
They were, correctly. But they were also Discoveries.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is a name that I think, I don't know.
I mean, I basically call them, you know, later disco generations because they're just boxes on wheels.
They're pretty cool cars, but
so let's talk about the LR2 first.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the demon child of the lineup. So if you were to like line up all of like Land Rovers from the last, let's say, 25 years, you would be hard pressed to pick that LR2 as a Land Rover because it really, out of all their cars, that's like the furthest thing from what we all imagine a Land Rover to look like.
It looks like a CRV.
It does. And it was priced as such. You know, it was their lowest priced. You could get a basic LR2 starting at like 30K. So, you know, you're basically buying a badge that said Land Rover, but having like a smaller, you know.
Yeah. So let me, I'm sorry, I got to tell this, but.
Go ahead.
When I lived in South Africa, I decided that I was going to go to Mozambique. And there's a little town on the edge of Mozambique with South Africa. It's called Ponta do Ouro. And it's basically a tourist town that a lot of South Africans vacation to. And it basically has little resorts with nothing there. And the resorts are just really kind of cool. And you can do all these sorts of marine activities. You know, you can see the dolphins, all that stuff, and scuba dive. But anyway, I wanted it for the adventure. I rented an LR2, remember, right-hand drive in South Africa. And clearly when I was looking at the map, I thought it was going to take me about 6 hours to get there. But I didn't realize that my Google Maps was in miles, and I was thinking in kilometers. So instead of 600 kilometers, I was actually looking at 600 miles. And I was thinking, it's not going to take that long. I was like, surely there's traffic there, and that's why it's telling me. Anyway, I rented the car, I picked it up, And in order to get into Punta Douro, first of all, you got to cross the border, which is really funny because the actual asphalt road ends at the border. And so there's a fence there and it ends and you go into Mozambique and it's dirt and you're on the dirt track. But and you need a 4x4 because the only way you can get in there is with a 4x4. In fact, they won't let you continue on that road unless you have a 4x4. I found this car to be outstanding on the highway. It was great. It made it all the way there. It was quick. It had a good amount of power. I was very happy with it. And then I got to Mozambique and I changed the little button setting for track, and it was even better than it was on the highway. So yes, it didn't look like a Land Rover. It was far away, but in actual capabilities, I found it to be outstanding. In fact, I pulled out a couple Toyotas with my car and a rope, and I didn't even have a tow hitch. I just latched it onto the back hatch, and I pulled out a couple of Toyotas in Punta Douro, Mozambique. Wow. Anyway, really fun trip.
So but the thing about the LR2s is, for some reason, like, you can probably find one probably for about $1,500. Like, these LR2s, for some reason, probably because, A, they just don't look like a Land Rover product. But if you were to, like, go online, you would easily find hundreds of them.
Yeah,
in
for
that,
sure.
Like, $1,000 to $3,000 range. I wouldn't really – I don't really foresee these LR2s ever becoming collectible, like, say, like the Freelanders.
Well, also, I want to make a note at the end. I'm going to let you
okay
about that.
So if you just wanted like a fun, like what I would call a beater car, for a couple grand, or you wanted to work on something like with your kid and you didn't care if they like beat the crap out of it, if it's still running, a lot of them really,
it's a great first car.
So
it's a great first car for a 16-year-old.
That being said, that's kind of might be their introduction into Land Rovers.
What about the 3 and 4?
So the LR3 and the LR4, I'm liking the 03, even though the 04 had a ton of like interior like upgrades and stuff. I'm still seeing some good buys in that first series of between the 3 and the 4. You can pick them up anywhere between like 5 and 8 grand. It has a great iconic look. A lot of people love some of the bumper modifications.
The white since most of the fender the wheel arches and stuff are plastic,
yeah,
and they're black, that contrast with white looks really nice. In fact, yeah, I almost bought one on an auction website on Copart the other day. The only thing is I couldn't get out to see it, and I wanted to see it, but I knew the suspension was gone. But
yeah. Anyway. So, I mean, I still think there's really good buys in the LR3s. Again, it's, you know, it's British, so most of the interior, if they had kids, is probably toast.
Shot.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, the interiors on the 3 and the 4 really just took a beating. They were just poorly built on the inside. But as far as, like, the look, you can still get really good deals. You know, the 04 ran a lot longer. So, you know, those are obviously going to still be up into the 30 grand. But I think right now, you know, finding a good LR3 is your best bet.
Yeah. And it's a cool car. It's got that high roofline. So I want to, you know, Dan, you touched on it. The LR2 is actually the evolution of the Land Rover Freelander. Now, for those of us that, well, for those of you, because I know it because I lived in Europe for many years. The Freelander was actually kind of the first departure from the typical Land Rover line. So up until, and I can't remember exactly the year that they came out. I think it would be 95, 90. Anyway, there's a two-door Land Rover called the Freelander that had kind of plastic bumpers, which was later the LR2 here in the United States and Freelander in the rest of the world. In fact, the South African LR2 that I had was a Freelander.
So the
it's badged as a Freelander.
The first Freelander was like
97. Okay, so I'm wrong about that. But that is an interesting car. Dan and I have talked about it. I think I'm going to find him one just because
it's on my radar, and there's a particular Freelander model that I'm kind of obsessed with right now. So, but they're really hard to find, and I'll touch on it at the end because we're going to talk about what we would buy if we had some money right now, but go ahead.
Well, let's go into that. So what would you buy if you had money right now?
So right now, as I was talking to my buddy, that there's this special Freelander that was a two-door, of course. I love a good two-door anything. And it's an SC3. So it's kind of like a G-Wagon Cabrio. So it's got like the hard front with a open back.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's actually Dan's handing me a picture of one.
Yeah. So, you know, that's something that I would probably want to just play around with for a little bit. It's not like a Geo Tracker, but like it's in that family.
It looks like the Isuzu Vihicross.
Yes. So that's something that, you know, if I had like the company that has it for sale, you know, they want 10 grand for it, but you know, I'm a cheap son of a bitch. So like
anyway, look it up. This is a 2003 Freelander SE3. And it's got like an open back, kind of like a,
And again, if you were to do a search for Freelanders in America, you're maybe going to find six in all of the country. But right now, I have some Japanese buddies that like are obsessed with Freelanders right now, and they're all buying Freelanders. So I kind of gauge that market. You know how like Japanese were like obsessed with Wagoneers forever and not so much anymore. So, you know, they're all buying these first and second gen Freelanders. So
well, we've got a year and a few months, and then we can bring one in because we're coming up on the 96 model
cycle
year
of,
cut.
Yep.
But anyway, that's a cool car. So here's the thing: if I had money right now, I think my buy
wanted to make money.
Well, if you wanted to make, I mean, if it was for me. Personally, like you, I have been wanting a manual two-door 3.9 Range Rover Classic. That's kind of what I've been wanting for a daily driver. But anyway, other than that, if you wanted to make money and you have money to spend, a Defender 130 is definitely going to be your pick. That is a rare car. It's a lot of fun. It's not any more complicated than the regular or any. It's not complicated. It's like a Defender 90 or 110. It's just got a bigger body and a pickup bed, which I think give it a really special and cool look. And I think it's actually a great city car because you can, if you're in a city that has a lot of potholes like Chicago, you're gonna be nice and comfortable in something like that. So my money would be on a Defender 130. But the other car that I also would like to find and it's a hard find is a two door Defender with the 3.9 V8 and a manual gearbox, and it might be unobtainium, but there has to be one out there.
There is, and we touched on this earlier. It can easily be made.
It can easily be made, yep. but anyway. So that's gonna be it for us today. We don't want to, you know, we tried not to go a lot longer than we expected. I think we did pretty well. Dan, you are a walking Land Rover manual. Thank you for joining us and for being here with me, because without you, this wouldn't be any fun.
And if someone wanted to shoot us an email, do we have?
We do. We want everybody to write us at rovertalk55@gmail.com. Now, we accept everything. Criticize us, correct us, tell us we're wrong, tell us we're idiots, tell us you like us. Whatever it is you want to tell us, just tell us.
Please.
And
I have thick skin. I don't care.
I don't either. I'm good. And if you want to follow us on Instagram, Dan's handle is WagonBoyTD. You can also find him with his 70,000 likes on Bring a Trailer and other sites as well. And I can rarely remember my Instagram. I think it's SRI2504 or 2405. I don't know why it's so complicated. But anyway, if you find Dan, you'll see a lot of likes and you'll find me.
Yeah.
So that's it for today. Thank you so much. And next episode is going to be interesting, but I'm not going to tell you what it's going to be about.
You have to tune in.
Tune in.